Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you are with us. We're talking this hour about money, specifically banking, why it works for some of our neighbors and not for others, and how to make it more fair. Data from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, the federal agency that insures banks, show that about 40% of Baltimore households are unbanked or underbanked. That basically means two out of every five households here rely on financial services outside the formal banking system. We're talking about money orders, check cashing outlets, and payday loans or auto title loans. Baltimore ranks in the top 10 of unbanked U.S. cities, with 14% of its household having no savings or checking accounts. And Baltimore isn't alone. A 2013 national survey by the FDIC estimated that nearly 10 million American households had no savings or checking account, and nearly 25 million households had a bank account but still made use of alternative financial services. If you put these two groups together, you have a group of about 93 million Americans, adults and children, who aren't connected very well to the formal banking system. Imagine for a second that you have no bank account, no credit card, or even a credit history. How would you deposit your paycheck? How would you pay your bills? If you had an emergency, where would you turn? Today we look at the factors behind why so many are living outside the formal financial system, and what the risks are when people turn to alternative financial services. To address these questions, Cassandra Jones Havard is here. She is Professor Havard at the University of Baltimore, where she teaches courses on corporate, commercial, and banking law. She also presented on this very topic of banked and unbanked as part of the University of Baltimore's Divided Baltimore course. Professor Havard, welcome to Midday.
Thank you very much.
I'm very glad that you are with us. So I've been flinging these terms around, banked and unbanked. Would you define them for us and tell us the difference?
Yes. Well, let's start with the underbanked. The underbanked are people who perhaps have a checking account, but who don't use the formal financial services economy very much. So these are often young people. They may have a checking account, but they rely on, say, their smartphone to use Venmo or PayPal and other alternatives for transferring money. And then there are the unbanked, and these are people who have absolutely no relationship with the formal banking system. And so often for a variety of reasons, they have turned away from that system and they do what we call fringe banking, which is they use, as you mentioned, pawn shops and money orders to pay bills. Pawn shops actually get loans, money orders to pay bills, and all sorts of alternative financial services.
So I, reading between the lines of what you said, but I want to ask you if I'm leaping to the right conclusion. Mm-hmm. I get the impression that perhaps with the unbanked, it's more of a choice. I mean, the underbanked, it's more of a choice, and the unbanked just actually, because of bad credit or something, can't get into the banking system.
Okay, I think maybe that's right. I think for the underbanked, some of it is a choice, and I think some of it is a lack of education and knowledge and understanding why they need to be in the formal financial economy. For the unbanked, I think
people
there are
who have no relationship.
No relationship whatsoever.
No
right.
checking account, no savings
right.
account.
And so some of it is bad credit, but some of it is the other requirements that banks have. So there are identity requirements, and there are sometimes terms and conditions about availability of funds.
Okay, so back up. I just want to go into this in some detail. Identity. You got to show some kind of identity. This
right.
is a problem.
You have to show sometimes government issued identity, and so right. Sometimes that is a problem for people.
People who don't, if they're not here legally, they don't have a government ID.
Right. Also, there are the availability problem is the cash availability is a problem, because if you go to a check casher, you can have access to the money in your paycheck immediately. Banks have a funds availability policy, and so you have to wait a period of time before you're able to get access to those funds unless you already have that amount of money on deposit.
So walk me through what some of the other factors are that might keep somebody from
from having a relationship with a bank.
I also think physical access is a problem, meaning geographically, the fact that banks are not located in communities in the same abundance that they were, say, 20 years ago. And so because of deregulation, lots of banks consolidated and they closed branches. And so they simply are not where people live and work in lots of urban areas.
Other reasons?
I think there also are, I want to call these perhaps psychological reasons, and that may not be the best term, but it is the idea that people feel disengaged from the formal economy. They feel as though they don't make enough money and that no one cares about the amount of money that they do make and what happens to it. And so they simply have a negative perception of what a formal banking relationship might provide for them.
So they're more comfortable with a payday loan.
I think over time they have become more comfortable with a payday loan or a check cashing outlet. Many of whom now, by the way, develop relationships with customers and have some of the same types of features that banks used to have. You know, for example, if you're a frequent customer, you know, perhaps you get, you know, some type of reduction on your fees. So the check cashing outlets have basically filled a niche and have determined how to keep customers coming.
That is Professor Cassandra Jones Havard of University of Baltimore Law School here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She teaches courses on corporate, commercial, and banking law. And we're talking about the problem, the issue of people having no relationship or a very tenuous relationship to the formal banking system. You can be part of this conversation. Do you know somebody who is in this situation? Are you sometimes in this situation? Tell us how it works for you. Join our conversation at 410-662-8780. That's our local number, 410-662-8780. Or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. So I just called it a problem for people to have a tenuous connection to the banking system. Is it a problem?
I think it is a problem.
Why?
For several reasons. First of all, I think if you're outside of the formal banking economy, you spend a lot of money cashing your check.
Fees.
Paying your bills. Right. So to cash a check, there usually is a check cashing fee. And so you have to pay that fee in order to get access to the paycheck. And then you have to take the paycheck and or the cash, I'm sorry, from the paycheck and purchase a money order to pay your bills. And so
you're paying on the way in and the way out, basically.
Exactly. You're paying twice. And so those fees actually sort of, they add up over time. And there's one study that says that a lot of households spend as much as 10% or the amount of money they spend on their food budget paying these check cashing fees.
That reminds me, how did you get interested in this issue?
Well, when I first started teaching banking law, that was going to be my area of expertise, I started trying to read everything, of course, I could find about banking law. And one of the things I stumbled upon was a New York Times article about a young woman who worked at Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. And because the branches in her neighborhood had closed, she had to go to a check casher every week to cash her $500 paycheck. And so she paid, I'm sorry, every 2 weeks, I think. She got paid $500 every 2 weeks. And she paid $13 every time she went to the check casher to pay, to cash her check. And I had worked at the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So, and they regulate banks. And I was living in Washington, and I think I was just astonished to understand how little access average, everyday citizens working hard have to the formal financial services economy.
So this wasn't something that had permeated into your work life at the FDIC?
It had not at all, though certainly there is a consumer affairs division, and as you mentioned in the opening, the FDIC certainly is aware of the problem and is doing studies and I think is doing what it can to encourage more financial inclusion.
So are the fees, the fact that you're basically watering down whatever money you can earn because you're paying fees to cash a paycheck, and then you're paying money order fees to pay bills. Is it the drain on the money that is the primary reason that being unconnected to the banking system is a problem?
No, I don't think it's just the drain on the money, though that is very significant. I think it also means that you don't establish deeper relationships with banks, and deeper relationships basically mean being able to set up a savings account, being able to get a loan, even a small dollar loan, because life has emergencies. And everyone at some point might need additional cash to meet their needs. And so without a relationship in the formal banking economy, to have a deposit account, most people, again, don't have a savings account. And so when they need a loan, instead they go to a payday lender. And that creates this vicious cycle of paying, of borrowing money for a short period of time, but then being unable to pay it back. And so you sort of keep borrowing and keep borrowing.
Because you have to borrow more to pay the interest on what you've already borrowed.
Right.
We already have callers here on Midday. We're talking to Professor Cassandra Jones-Havard from the University of Baltimore Law School. And Alexander from Baltimore is calling us. Alexander, welcome to Midday.
Hello, thank you.
Your question.
Well, in reference to what you were speaking on and having just not necessarily bad relationships with banks, but having tenuous relationships and having to necessarily go bank to bank to bank, and I was listening to what the individual was saying on hold there, and basically it's not necessarily a drain on money, because money is money. We have to earn it. We have to do what we need to do to get that money, of course. But when you're doing disingenuous business with an institution such as a bank, you know, something federally instituted with rules, and of course we should be reading 40 pages of documentation before we agree to things and sign things. But I myself have had the issues where I find that after 2 or 3 months of the courtship, almost like the honeymoon phase of the bank, and then the caveats add up where, oh, there are monthly finance fees, and oh, you better be direct depositing a certain amount of money, and you, things of that nature, where it's not that it's completely unreasonable to have rules to deal with the bank, but it's almost that it should be much more publicized. It shouldn't be so much about, oh, look at these mortgages we can save you money on, look at these house loans, and combine all your banking with us and we'll save you money, because in the end, it feels disingenuous that you weren't told necessarily that after a month or after 3 months or, oh, if your job's changed or if your address is different, that things just come up and all of a sudden, well, it's just, I'd rather move to a new bank for like the year period where they treat me well and then move on again. And maybe that's me being so young. I am only 26, but that's the sort of thing where it feels, well, you know.
So Alexander, you feel like the disclosure isn't clear enough up front of what your long-term fees are going to be, but you sound like you're kind of enjoying the speed dating that you're doing with banks, that you think it's working for you right now.
Not necessarily. I mean, I understand. I just feel more of a jovial tone in my voice, because it's not a problem, and like I said, there is a certain amount of, I should be reading these things to begin with.
Let's hear what Professor Havard thinks of all this.
Well, it's very interesting because I think, yes, is it Alexander?
Alexander.
Alexander represents the underbanked, and he's right in that age group. These are usually...
You fit the profile, Alexander.
These are usually people, you know, in their mid-20s, you know, almost 30s, who find alternative ways of doing banking. Now, he's in the formal banking economy, but it sounds like he moves around because he's not satisfied with the services that he gets. Certainly, all those many pieces of paper are because of the disclosures that the FDIC mandates and regulates and tells banks that they have to give. But I think one of the great things that's happening now as a result of the subprime crisis is that we now have a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that is trying to oversee what banks do more closely in terms of customer relations and make sure that customers are satisfied and they feel as though they have the information and the knowledge that they need to transact their business in a way that is beneficial to them.
Alexandra, I appreciate your calling us. We're going to take more calls after we take a quick break. We're going to talk more about the risks of fringe banking, and we'll welcome your calls. Our local number is 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Do you use informal financial services like money orders or check cashing instead of banks? Are there brick-and-mortar banks in your community? Any of those questions, give us a call. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Professor Cassandra Jones Havard from the University of Baltimore Law School is with us for the hour. You can be too. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. About 14% of Baltimore households operate without a savings or checking account. And another one-fourth of homes here may have a bank account, but they still rely on alternative financial services like money orders, check cashing outlets, payday loans. Being unbanked or underbanked can come with high fees and a lack of financial security. Discussing this with us in this hour is Professor Cassandra Jones Havard of the University of Baltimore Law School. We're talking about the factors that lead to fringe banking and what can be done to connect more people to banks. And I want to pick on a phrase I think you used at some point in our conversation earlier about the financial education, the role that financial literacy plays in this. I mean, does the problem of people not connecting to the banking system start in school?
Well, perhaps that's something to think about. I certainly think that, say, 20 or 30 years ago, there were classes that perhaps taught more consumer education than now, and people were aware of some very basic financial literacy skills or were taught those in a better way. So schools used to always make sure that students understood how to do budgeting. They understood basically a simple balance sheet and what's the difference between, say, an asset and a liability, as it sort of helps someone figure out their own net worth. They understood things like compound interest, which is for savings is great because it means that you get an additional interest on the deposit that you've made. You earn interest on it, and it compounds and just sort of keeps growing. So maybe some of it is financial literacy. I'm not sure that that's the entire problem that we have right now with, you know, statistics like you reported, because, again, I think some of it's about access and what's available for people to use.
And what is the access like in Baltimore? You know, we talk about food deserts when we talk about neighborhoods that don't have access to healthy food because there's no grocery there. Are you talking about financial deserts?
Yes, I call them bank deserts. And the fact that if you look at a map of Baltimore, you will see it proliferated with check cashing outlets. And you will see the mainstream financial institutions basically, I guess, in the downtown area. Predominantly in the downtown area, not in the neighborhoods where people live and where people work. And so a lot of it is about access.
So it's just hard to get physically to a place that's an insured, regulated bank.
It can be. Now, I thought about this when actually we were talking to, I think it was Andrew.
Alexander.
Alexander, I'm sorry. That in addition to federally insured banks, of course, there are other types of institutions in the formal banking economy that consumers can think about using. So, for example, credit unions are an alternative to traditional banks, which provide many of the same services now. Certainly, there's the deposit feature. There's a savings feature. Now, many of them also provide mortgages. And so that's another way that people can be in the formal banking economy and perhaps feel like they have a closer relationship. Because credit unions are based on affiliation. And so to be a member of a credit union, there's some kind of affinity group. You work together. I think there's one in Maryland that's based on the Maryland State Employees. Mm-hmm. So those are, and I say that to say that there are lots of those available and ways for people to connect with them and to use that versus the fringe banking outlets.
Interesting. Let's talk to Sam, who is calling us from Owings Mills. Sam, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you?
Just great.
I'm 23, and I actually am on the opposite spectrum. I was raised in Baltimore County. Every bank you can think of is in my neighborhood. But I'm actually choosing to use Rush Card, which is pretty much like a prepaid debit card. And that's because I get my money 2 days earlier than using a regular bank. Don't really have to worry about walking up to a bank teller trying to get cash out or anything. I can use pretty much Royal Farms or any First Mariner bank. And also, I've pretty much used about four different bank accounts as well, but kind of ran into overdraft fees and different hidden fees. And I feel like financial literacy probably would have helped me out in school, because I really never learned about finances or credit cards or anything like that. Pretty much got a credit card sent to my house when I was about 19 and kind of blew that. And my mom kind of tried to help me, but it wasn't enough. And I feel like school, at least school education, would have helped me a little bit on credit counseling and how to balance a budget or worry about my net worth and savings and whatnot.
Sam, I want to make sure I understand. You use a prepaid debit card
called a Rush Card.
How does it get prepaid, and how do you do that?
You pretty much go online, you sign up, put your address in, they send you a card, it's a Visa card, and I get paid every week for my job, so I'm supposed to get paid on Fridays, but I get paid every Thursday, and it's like that extra day that I don't really have to worry about it. It's really simple, actually.
So you have your, in other words, you have your paycheck deposited into a prepaid debit card?
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay. Professor Havard.
This is certainly a very common way that, again, a lot of people use the financial services economy. Again, one of the problems is that it allows an alternative for perhaps bill paying and having access to cash, but it doesn't allow for that deeper engagement and provide people ways to save money or to think about saving money and to develop a credit history so that if they need a loan, they are able to get one at a favorable rate.
Sam, have you given thought to either of those aspects? I mean, do you feel the system is working pretty well for you, or are you worried about the fact that you're not developing
right
a credit?
Right now it's not. I mean, I'm 23. I just got my own apartment, so I am thinking of just me and my girlfriend getting a home. I know we're going to have to get a home loan years from now or something like that, or even getting another car. So I have thought about, getting another bank and just seeing how that would work out, but right now it's working for me, so it hasn't really come across yet.
Well, I appreciate your sharing your story with us. It's helpful to understand how it's working for you. Thank you. Sandy is calling us from Baltimore and may have the same issue. Sandy, welcome to the show. Oh no, Sandy's gone. let's talk to Stephen in Baltimore. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm 54 years old, and I live in Baltimore City, and I've used banks for a lot of years. But I realized that their business model is basically set up to make a profit off of me, and whether I want to pay them or not. So the fees were just getting ridiculous.
Bank fees.
Bank fees for everything. And it's almost had developed into an adversarial relationship in which I just felt as though every time I turned around, they were trying to take money out of my bank account. So now I use prepaid cards. I still have a bank account. I rarely use it other than to make deposits of checks. But even with that, people send me money directly to my PayPal or to my American Express. So I think that the traditional bank's business model has kind of fallen behind the times. And in terms of credit, even when I was using the bank, regardless, if I had an insane amount of money in there, they would still just look at my credit score and make the determination at that point.
Stephen, I appreciate all the issues that you have put on the table. Let me ask Professor Havard to address them.
Well, Stephen's actually an excellent example, again, of someone who's underbanked, but who's well aware and understands the formal financial economy. It's interesting to comment on the business model. I'm not sure that I'm quite able to analyze it as well as perhaps it needs to be. But certainly banks do have fees, and the customer has to shop around to find a bank that has, you know, the fee structure that sort of fits their particular profile and their particular needs. And certainly there are people who have left the formal banking economy again for the same reasons that Stephen identified, sort of the adversarial relationship, feeling as though they're always negotiating with the bank about the fees. Banks are businesses. You know, they do make money using other people's money. Credit unions also. And so this is part of the way, certainly, that the economy works. I guess the more interesting point, though, also in terms of the alternatives that Stephen is using, things like PayPal and American Express, these are, in some respects, more sophisticated, but also alternative financial services providers, and they are using, you know, their technological platforms to basically help people transmit money and transfer money from one place to the other. So though they are not formal financial institutions, they are providing a critical role and probably are filling a gap for people like Stephen who are disgruntled.
By they, you mean the fringe?
He mentioned American Express,
okay,
and PayPal as ways of transferring money.
Stephen, thank you for calling Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Here with me in the studio is Professor Cassandra Jones-Havard of the University of Baltimore School of Law. You can be part of this conversation, too. You can call 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Professor Havard, I want to pursue, though, the question that came to my mind listening to Stephen about who's making money here. I mean, we were talking earlier about fees that you said were onerous, that for money orders and all these fees that I would pay if I weren't part of the banking system. But, you know, we hear from Stephen that the fees aren't nothing in the banking system, too. Who is making how much money? And where? I mean, how much are the fringe banking institutions making off this compared to what banks make?
Fringe banking is a very profitable industry. And it's very interesting to think about, sort of juxtapose banks not having, say, no-frills banking accounts or banking accounts that would be affordable for, you know, people who want to not use fringe banking, and to compare that with, you know, the amount of money that fringe banks make. The number escapes me right now, but it's in the millions.
Millions locally? Or
yes. Yes. And so billions nationally, the amount of money that goes through the check cashing industry in terms of profits.
Well, I guess, I mean, the one of the questions that raises in my mind then is, if there is a lot of money to be made from customers whom the regulated traditional banks have disdained, why aren't those banks trying to make those profits?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think because their traditional accounts expected direct deposits, expected a certain amount of money to stay in those demand accounts. Because, again, that's a part of the way banks make money, is by using other people's money. And so they need the money to stay in those accounts, minimum balances, so that the model works. The other thing, though, to think about is whether or not they could offer a different type of account for people who are financially excluded, and an account that would meet their needs in terms of, again, funds availability, being able to have access to those funds, and the fees not being so onerous.
Bo still with us? Bo is calling from Baltimore. Bo?
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much.
I understand you have a comment or a question about fees.
Yes, I think one effect of recent federal banking legislation has been the migration of bank revenue from investment income to fee-based income. And my question is, to what degree has the increased emphasis on fees influenced the reduction in branch banking and in particular access to banking generally?
So let me make sure I understand the question. Maybe you're seeing a linkage that I hadn't thought of. Bo, you're asking whether the fact that banks are expecting to make more and more money from fees affects where or how many branches they're willing to have?
Well, the recent federal legislation has influenced the income stream which banks get now, and that has changed their model, it seems to me, fairly significantly. And two of those changes that appear are a decrease in branch banking and, as your discussion has highlighted today, a reduction in access to banking. And I wonder if you have any comments on that. Or
Professor Hubbard?
Yeah, I think the caller raises an interesting point. I would say that there is certainly a huge diversification now in financial services. And so traditionally, the bank did have investments and made money off of those products. And a lot of those products now are in other entities. Consumers are, you know, have a wide array of other types of places to put savings and to, you know, to make money off of investments. And I think that coupled with deregulation, again, going back now more than 20 years, affected the number of brick-and-mortar banks and where they were placed. The industry consolidated. And whereas we used to have, say, in a city like Baltimore, 20 different bank names, the number of banks that we, or the number of types of banks that we have has been dramatically reduced.
We need to take another quick break here. We're talking to Professor Cassandra Jones-Havard of the University of Baltimore School of Law about banking, the banked and the underbanked and the unbanked, and taking your calls. You can add to the conversation at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. We're going to be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cass. We're talking about money and banking this hour with University of Baltimore School of Law Professor Cassandra Jones-Havard. She teaches banking, corporate, and commercial law courses. We've been discussing the consequences of living without a bank account and the risks of relying on alternative banking services such as check cashing outlets. We're taking calls at 410-662-8780 and emails at midday@wypr.org. And Dale from Baltimore, I think, wants to challenge one of the premises of this conversation. Dale, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I was listening. It's an interesting topic. And a couple of callers touched on things that are close to me, meaning they use alternative methods, yet they have banking accounts. I'm a 50-some-year-old, and I grew up with the lessons of savings accounts, et cetera. So you try to go that route, but now these days have migrated to the point where, as one of the previous callers pointed out, they're dragging fees out of you if you don't maintain $10,000 in a specific account. They'll migrate you to another lower-level type of checking account. So the concept or the idea that people are, quote-unquote, underbanked or using fringe type of services seems a little misplaced, in that the banks seem to be, unless you have a certain amount of money or a certain flow of money through your accounts, they force you to go to alternative banking or ways of moving your money around because you don't meet their criteria for a full service relationship.
Let me ask Professor Havard to address that.
I think the point that the caller is raising is one that the Consumer Financial Protection Board is becoming well aware of, and it is actually challenging banks to create accounts that have different risk level thresholds so that someone like Dale would not feel pushed out of the financial system. And so just recently, the director of the CFPB, which was created after the subprime crisis.
This is the federal agency that is,
yes,
that is
basically now looking out for consumer protection. And they have jurisdiction to register, to regulate banks as it relates to consumer financial protection issues. Recently, the director sent a letter to financial institutions challenging them to create the kinds of accounts that underbanked and unbanked consumers need. And so the significance of that is that as the regulator, they have authority to monitor what the banks are doing and to sort of challenge them to create a variety of accounts so that access would be widened.
So what, in your view, Professor Havard, what should be done to increase financial inclusion, to pull more people, to make more people comfortable,
right,
in the banking system?
I think actually there are lots of things that can be done. I think the move by the CFPB to challenge financial institutions to sort of study their own profiles and to figure out how they can provide more financial products to people who are financially vulnerable is a great first step. I think it'd be great if we would set measurable goals and begin to try to reach them in terms of bringing people into the formal economy. So in other words, perhaps a 5 or 10 year plan to reduce the numbers that you started the show with, where we would be able to measure the progress of people leaving the informal economy and coming into the formal banking economy.
One of our listeners, Andrew, wrote us about an idea that you actually wrote about in the Baltimore Sun about 2 years ago. Andrew asked, in many countries, post offices provide basic banking services. Every community has a post office, and many post offices could use more business. What does your guest think of the idea of having our post offices provide banking services?
You're right. I'm an advocate for postal banking. I think that is certainly a favorable alternative of providing a low-cost way to cash checks and to also purchase money orders, as you can do already at the post office. And so it's very interesting to note that until 1967, the post office in America did have some financial services functions. And in other countries, now, post office are very critical to the financial services economy.
And that is something that that Congress would need,
yes,
to mandate.
Congress,
right,
would need to mandate, though there is some suggestion that some basic things post offices could begin to do now, perhaps with banks, in terms of partnering with them, using the post office sort of as...
a bank lobby?
Yes. Yes.
Basically?
Yes. It would require coordination.
But banks already have, it's pretty easy for banks to have ATMs kind of anywhere.
That's true. It is easy to have ATMs. And so certainly that access to electronic banking is very important. And that is that's helpful. But a lot of times people need to actually go into the facility for some of the transactions that they are doing. And I think as it extends now, banks actually don't have the kind of mobile technology that is safe and secure enough for people to do everything online and, say, using mobile platforms.
Carol is calling us from Towson. Carol, welcome to the Midday.
Thank you. I worked at district court for 36 years, 20 years in the garnishment section, and I'm aware that in order for a creditor to enforce his judgment, he can garnish a bank account. So I was wondering if some people are not wary of this, if they see other people in their community having bank garnishments in which the bank is obliged to put the entire amount into escrow until it's disposed of, if they are afraid of this happening and therefore they don't want to have bank accounts.
Interesting question, Carol. Thank you for calling.
I think that certainly is a great example of some of the reasons that people begin to exit the formal economy and try to find alternative ways to do their banking business.
Professor Hefford, we've talked about what you call bank deserts. I didn't ask you explicitly, what is the racial component to financial inclusion that you see?
The racial component seems to be that race and space converge, meaning that the geographical locations that we call bank deserts are places that are predominantly African-American or people of color. And so these are the neighborhoods and the communities that don't have access to the formal financial services through a brick-and-mortar location, but their neighborhoods are proliferated with check cashing outlets.
And so is this something that bank regulators are looking at?
It is something that bank regulators have jurisdiction to regulate. There is something called the Community Reinvestment Act that allows bank regulators to look at the geographical locations of branches and to see whether or not those locations are serving the community. The problem with the CRA as it exists now is that it is most significant when banks are merging, and banks have consolidated so much that there are very few mergers. And so this convenience and needs test very seldom is used to stop a transaction, which is what it was used for previously.
Janice has called us from Baltimore. Janice, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have enjoyed the comments that were made by the lady that just called and was questioning the whole idea of being underbanked, as well as Stephen's comments about the fact that the banks are really not as friendly as your guests might want us to think. I have banked at M&T Bank for more than 15 years. I'm also 50 years old. Could not get a loan from them. Yes.
I think you may have the radio on, and it's probably confusing you. Can you turn that down?
I'm in a store. I'm sorry. I was waiting for a long time. But my point is that I think that our whole system, going back to like 1913 and the setting up of the Federal Reserve, that is not regulated, that is not controlled by our Congress, which means it's not controlled by us, it just lets us know that in our society, you know, banking and the whole financial system is really geared to really help those that are wealthy. It isn't geared to help just regular people like me. Banks are there to make business. They use your money to make money. They give you minimal benefits. And I don't have prepaid cards and things like that. I still just deal with the bank, but I wish there was another option, because I really honestly don't think that our whole financial system is fair. I'll just listen to what you guys have to say off the line. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling, Janice.
I think the disengagement is, again, very common because consumers don't feel like traditional banks are meeting their needs, and they don't feel like they can get the services that they deserve from those institutions. What's very interesting is that in other developed countries, financial inclusion is considered a very important value. And so there are examples of other countries that allow every citizen to have a very basic checking account.
Who's doing it right in your view?
I think the UK does it right. I think Germany does it right.
What do they do?
They allow banks, I'm sorry, they allow customers to have just a basic checking account. It may not have an overdraft function, but a no-frills account that can be used to deposit funds, that can be used to cash checks, and that eventually will allow the customer to migrate over to be able, say, to get a loan when a loan is needed, because there now is a relationship and a credit history that is favorable.
I think we have time to squeeze in one more question. We did have a few minutes. Diana from Southwest Baltimore, can you make your point quickly? Diana?
I wanted to know if there was a relationship between traditional banks and these fringe banks, and if the banking laws that are present on the books now, if they do or do not prevent these kinds of relationships.
Thanks for the question, Diana.
All right. I am not aware of a relationship between the two. And that's all.
Well, but I thought one of your one of the ideas you have for how to make the system more financially inclusive was that there could be some kind of partnerships between banks and non-bank institutions.
Perhaps there could be. I think the check cashing industry right now makes so much money that it's going to be very difficult to convince them to come into the system, which is why I think that postal banking in that regard is the better idea, the stronger idea in terms of, you know, providing the kind of broad access that's needed.
To wrap this up, we have just 30 seconds left. So what advice then would you give people who don't feel comfortable, who don't feel banks are meeting their needs? And as some of our callers said, don't try to convince us. I mean, it's not a system for us.
Well, I would want, especially if you're using a check cashing outlet, I would want them to sit down and tally up the amount of money they're spending and to see how much it is. Because I think because it is a fee that that people incur regularly, they don't realize how much money they're spending to cash a paycheck and to purchase money orders. It has become an established way of life, and they don't understand that there are alternatives. I would also say explore credit unions or other types of mainstream financial institutions that maybe don't look quite like the traditional bank.
I really appreciate your opening the door on this topic for us. Thank you so much. Thanks. Cassandra Jones-Havard is professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She teaches courses on corporate, commercial, and banking law. I want to thank you. I want to thank our listeners for taking part in this conversation. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you'll be back with us tomorrow. We're going to look at the bioethics of organ donation. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.